Hello, I'm Angela, and welcome to The Downhill Slide. On this podcast, we talk about life over the age of the midway point, I guess kind of like 50, and the lessons that we've learned. And recently, I realized pretty much me and everybody I know is their bodies are falling apart. And I had a bit of a scare, which was a little confronting. So I thought I'd drag someone to the microphone, known as the Rev. G'day.
Hi, Angela.
And as usual, with most people I've met around here in the Southern Highlands, I met you at the Surveyor General.
Could happen.
And I see you in there all the time, and you chat to people in a way that's a little bit different. Tell us what you do when you are going out and chatting to people at the Surveyor General.
Okay. Look, significantly, people look for community, okay? And they look for community wherever it was. And years ago, that was probably in a church situation. But churches have sort of, I'm a chaplain and a reverend, but they've sort of lost their way a little bit. And there's a sense in that churches now wait for someone to walk through the door. Well, that's not how it works. It's actually not a biblical sort of teaching, or it's not even a pattern from the early church. It's actually just if we get comfortable and we stay in this church and we'll wait for people to walk in, and that doesn't happen. So when I first started with Care Works years and years and years ago, I was informally of a Thursday afternoon, I'd turn up, have a few beers, and you'd end up, it was really odd, you'd end up sort of going, all right, we're having a bit of a talk about this with someone or some individual, and someone would be having a problem with this, or maybe this, or whatever. And people are a bit more sort of comfortable, and so you'd go to the next room. And it sort of, well, it didn't become my office, but people knew that I would be there every Thursday. And I could walk in, if you like, grab a beer, look to the left and see, oh, there's someone in the office. And they'd be... and it's not an office. It's not an office. And so it sort of grew from there. I have done the weddings of 4 people who have been either bar staff there or associated with the pub. I've done weddings over the years. I've done christenings over the years. And obviously a number of funerals, but it's all, I suppose it's all stemmed from trying to take a, well, not take the church to the pub, but just be open and listening to people in a place where they are, rather than forcing people to, if people need help, they don't need to cross another bridge to get it. Does that sort of make sense?
It does. Do you find, like, as I mentioned before, about when people have confronting news, do you find they seek you out?
Yes, they do. Yes.
Even though it's a close community here, people know
everyone. Yeah, it is a
everyone.
Close community.
So what I mean is, like, do you think people are, because people can be a closed shop, can't they? Like when they are confronted by bad news or whatever, but they don't seem to have any fear of coming to talk to you. Do you find that?
I can't explain why, but yes. Okay, so I don't sort of get that. I mean, there's a couple of things, right? So I know there's a cross on the shirt, but and people don't know me. People, if you ask people who I am, they can't tell you my name. They know me as the Rev.
Mm.
Right? But that's sort of as much of a sort of a pushing of a religious or a particular belief system. I can minister, and I feel that God called me to minister to people. I don't minister to those of the same faith as me or of a different. It doesn't matter. Okay, it doesn't matter. The beautiful thing, if you look at some of the work that Mother Teresa did in India, she ministered to the untouchable. She ministered to all the different people. It didn't matter. And so you have to recognise, and I think it's actually a Christian principle that everyone has something of the image of God in them. Okay? And no matter what their belief system is, that's what I can see, and so that's what I feel I need to minister to.
So let's go back a little bit. Where did this start? Where did this calling of yours start? Were you brought up with a particular church, religion?
Yeah, I'm commonly what's called, people wouldn't recognise it now, an MK. I'm a missionary's kid.
Oh.
Okay, yeah, so it's not as, but if you were to mention that in some circles, like, oh, yeah, no, we get that, that's okay. My mum was a nurse in Arnhem Land with Church Missionary Society, and we were across Roper River, Groote Eylandt, Rose River, Umbakumba, Numbawa, Ngurka, all those different places all across the Northern Territory. I was born in Darwin Hospital. So that's where I was from. And then when we came back, we're third generation here, but that was sort of where I was born. And then when I was six and a half, seven, something like that, we came back down for me to start school down here, and for circumstances had changed. BHP had bought the mining rights to Groote Eylandt, and we were there, and so it became a mine, and things sort of changed up there, and my parents sort of came back to here, and then we had a little tiny church that was at Tarmor, a little tiny Baptist church of all things, because it was an Anglican tradition that we were from, and they were just beautiful, beautiful, beautiful old people in this church, and just lovely, caring people, and they were sort of like family, and I stayed there right through with my teens, and when I finally got married, I came up here, and we went to church in Barrel, and while I was at the church of Barrel, being, you know, your mid-20s, I suppose, you go, right, I'm going to change the world. And you realise that, well, you probably, if you want to change the world, you need to start by changing yourself maybe first. And so that sort of sat with me. I thought, oh, we need to do things a bit differently here. And that just sat with me, I suppose, till I was in my 40s. And in my 40s, I felt a sort of conviction to go, nah, better do something about this. So I went and trained and got a degree in theology, and then did a dip in after that, and was ordained. But I never sensed that I was called to be a general purpose pastor or a minister in a particular parish. I actually thought my calling was to, they now identify it as chaplaincy, but back then it was just sort of, oh, who's that? It's someone that, you know, they're associated with it. But chaplaincy is a real thing. It's been identified probably more in armed services and in war conflicts than it has been in general community for years and years and years. So that's, and then I went and trained and did that. So that's where that has come from. And I've been involved like that sort of ever since. So I farm to keep, my wife Robin teaches to keep me in farming, which in turn keeps me off the streets, I suppose.
But
that doesn't, this is not going, is it? No.
But the streets is kind of, that's basically what you were saying before. Mm. You don't have to be in a church.
No.
To make people aware of God, or to make people aware that they are not alone.
No. I'll extend it even further than that. Do you know that I will, in my experience, I've come across a lot of people, and they may be ambivalent, indifferent, even angry, and that anger very often is not against God, but it is against the church.
Mm.
There is a distinction. There is a distinction.
Okay? Mm.
And I mean, I know we've seen the recent history, and there's no excuses at all for some of the appalling things that people have done in the name of God. I can't, and it's actually a very difficult, almost impossible thing to reconcile. You know, that's even just for me. And very often you'll find that in a chaplain, what I call a chaplaincy situation, you've got this hurdle to jump over because they're looking and going, well, you know, what is this?
Mm.
So it's I'm probably more angry at those that have done the wrong thing than the average person walking the street. Oh, you'll never find me defend anyone that has done the wrong thing to someone, be them a child, someone in aged care, someone. There is just no reason for it, and there is, and God Himself will be the judge, and He will not be easy on it. Mm. Okay, so those that are called to be ministers must minister from grace and truth, and they must not take advantage of people. It just can't happen. And it does, and you go, really? Anyway, sorry.
this is what I'm interested in, because you don't seem to have that building around you. You still seem to walk with God.
I like that.
And it's a nice thing. Do you think it has changed with regards to the way people respond to you? Is it God they're looking for? When they come to you and they're full of fear or anger or despair, are you talking as a man, do you think, or are you talking about a man of experience, or are you talking when you try to console them as a man of God?
Okay, that's a really, really good question. And in a perfect situation, and when you can, and you can actually sense it when you're speaking to people, it should be both. Hmm. Okay, it should be both. Let me tell you. One example of it, and this is a true story from a local. And one of the locals, a dear friend, most probably ardent atheist in the whole of and a dear friend, and he did get a terminal diagnosis. I can still remember the phone call. And it rang up, and I go, "Oh, you know what can I do for you?" And chatted, and he said, "Oh no, look, I'm actually in hospital, and I need to see you in your other capacity." He called it the other capacity. Anyway, I went, and it was sad, and we lost him far too early. And it's funny, you know, we never talked about faith at all. We just kept doing what we could do to make it sort of a little bit more comfortable for him and for those that were around him and all that sort of stuff in the palliative situation. And it was okay, and he had a it went well. Okay. And the last thing that he ever said to me, because he said, I wasn't looking for God when I spoke to you, but I think He found me.
Wow.
That's true. That's true. And I hold that there. Mm. Okay. You can't see me beating my chest on the microphone. But there, very, very true. Very, very true. So that's more about what I do and who you are and all that sort of stuff, I suppose. But that's a true local story. Another one for you, and if I'm talking too much, let me know. You know, Dan, you've got questions you want to ask me, I suppose. But when someone's given a diagnosis, which is like an end of life diagnosis, there's a couple of things. We're all given this diagnosis. You're actually given this diagnosis when you're born. Right? It's a destination we're all going to get to. You're just given the time of arrival. So if you frame a diagnosis like that, then you can start to separate some of the components of it. Okay. So if you look at that, your first responsibility, well, in that situation for me, my first responsibility is the person that's in front of me that's been given that diagnosis, okay? And to start with, the very first thing you do is almost remove the periphery around. So those that might be around that person, because they'll have different expectations and understandings of what they think should occur or will occur or whatever. And you need to cut through that to the person who's been given this news, okay? And then you need to see where they are in the journey of receiving that news. And that can vary from a scale that's that far that way to a scale that's that far that way. Okay, so some people, I have sat with people who are ready, willing and able. Like, that's fine. I've had a good life, and that's cool. I'm all right with that. And on the other end of the scale, the extreme, why me? Is at the other end of that scale, and everywhere in between, there is something along that sort of journey. Okay.
I was interested to see what you said about the people around the individual concerned.
Yeah.
Recently, when I had a bit of a confronting moment health-wise, something I just did not expect, that there was something wrong with my heart.
Coming out of the blue,
out of the blue, because I was going for something else, and then they just did a random check and went, oh, something's wrong here. And to be told that you've had a cardiac event and that you could have a massive cardiac event at any moment,
bit confronting. Yeah.
Right, okay. It did turn out a little bit different because I am deformed, it seems. I mean...
you got a perfect heart.
A lot of people would say to me, yes, we've known that for a long time, Angela, but I have a deformity. But I've still had a cardiac event. And because the way of the world, you've got to wait 3 years before you can get to see a specialist. So I'm waiting to find out how can I prevent that. I don't know. I don't know what the go is, right? So, but when I first heard, and I'm just going, this isn't right. And the irony is I kept saying, maybe I'm just deformed. and it turns out I am. But I have had some sort of cardiac event. And number one, I don't know when. Number two, I don't know how to stop that. But I could not get over what happened around me with the people that I love, because as you probably know, I'm a long way from my old friends and family.
That's hard.
I'm not unable to be with them. And I was supposed to go and see them the weekend before, because they rushed me into hospital to get this stuff sorted. And I decided not to go. But the effect of saying, well, I'm not going to go, I mean, pretty much, I thought my brother was basically saying, well, you should be here because this could be before you cark it. Come back.
Well, I suppose that's why I'm saying you see through to that, because you really don't.
Well, you anyway, do, because but that can mess you up. I was messed up. I'm going, oh, no, what if I'm going to die? I haven't seen my nephews, I haven't seen my brother, I haven't seen my friends and family. And what?
Let me get off the surgical bed just for a minute, will you, and I'll be back in a while.
I've got a list. I've got a list. I've got to do all this stuff to make everyone feel better, including myself. But I did say to him, I said, well, I would rather be on that gurney going, I would like to return to see my family again one day.
I'd rather be around for a bit more, yeah.
Rather than, well, I've said goodbye.
that's it. I'm out of here.
Doesn't matter. Yeah. But it was interesting, the impact, because there was so much concern. I was blown away by the concern. It's my husband peering through the window of the studio.
Do I blow a raspberry at him or not?
Blow a raspberry, I say rest. I better not, because he's going to make us coffee.
Oh, right.
No, it's all right. You can keep working on the roof.
Go hard, son. A what?
He's got a heap of telegraph poles. I don't know. Well, actually, this is a... It's not a live podcast, but we are recording live. I don't know what's going on out there, but we'll talk to my husband later. But he's actually another.
That's right. Not good.
That's Paul.
You love him. Go on.
So, well, this is another. This is a man. My husband is the walking miracle because he had a massive stroke that should have killed him.
Yes.
And they were just blown away by his recovery. Now he's a man who had no depression after his stroke. Nothing. Mm. He just went, well, I'm alive. I'll just keep doing what I'm doing. Which is a bit naughty because he's not supposed to be doing what he's doing. He's up on the roof doing some stuff, and
I didn't see him.
He's on blood thinners. If he cuts himself, he bleeds out. He just doesn't seem to be fearful of any of that. He's not even supposed to be drinking down the pub, and yet because it's bad for his brain, but he just does, and I find it difficult to stop him from doing that because he embraces life in a way that. Oh, I won't say I won't, but a lot of people would be living in fear because of what has happened to him. He doesn't live in fear.
No.
But so many people do.
Oh, that's a very real thing. And I mean, the fine line, I suppose, is somewhere between living in fear and living. Is that makes mm. Yeah, like you sort of can't, if you push the living in fear to the end point, well, that's a bit ordinary.
Well, I'm fearful every day. Yeah. I will freely admit that. I'm frightened of every day. I got a bit of PTSD from what happened to Paul, but just with, I wake up every day and think, you know, is this it? And I can't be the only one that does that.
A lot of people
experienced a lot of death in their life, seen a lot of people pass on and have that same fear.
There is also a fair bit of science to sort of say that there can be like a cumulative effect on that too. So that, like, in terms of it sort of builds up and builds up and builds up and builds up and builds up. And I suppose the answer is not, you better, you can't ignore that's what you feel when you get up. I know that that's not the answer. But the answer is to find that moderate point where you go, well, okay, the sun's shining. Although we haven't been able to say that for 6 months, have we?
No, there hasn't been a lot of sun shining.
And everything's good in the world. No, it's not. We're all getting bogged. But anyway, that's okay.
Well, I actually find the older I've gotten, the more it doesn't bother me. I'm not bothered. It's annoying that we have this constant rain, but I remember the drought.
Yeah, so do I.
So I guess, and the same as I find the older I've gotten, the less I'm bothered when I wake up in the morning going, oh, am I going to die today? Or is somebody I love going to die today? When you lose so many people, you do get into that habit. But the fear is not as great for me now as it once was.
Yeah, well, that's actually probably just a process of you working out, and you probably do it subconsciously, working out strategies to go, you know what? Yeah, we'll just take every day as it comes. I mean, it's almost trite to say that, but our own beings do that to us. I go, well, you know what? Got up this morning. I had one old bloke used to at the nursing home, one of the nursing homes that I was looking after at Thirroul. He was an ardent Sydney Morning Herald reader. Ardent, unbelievable. And he, you know, like if the Sydney Morning Herald hadn't arrived when it was supposed to arrive, oof.
Cranky pants.
Oh, went off his nut. Anyway. But every time you go, how you going today, mate? And you go, oh, no, I'm good. Check the obituaries and I'm not in it yet. Job's right. That's what he used to say. You remember these funny little sayings? You know? Getting back to the being given terminal news and all that sort of stuff, one old farmer guy who was here, was a dear friend and local for years and years and years. And anyway, he got a diagnosis with cancer and he was, you know, it wasn't real flash. He went into hospital and and he said to me, listen, Rev, I'd like you to do a funeral. And I said, oh, righto, I suppose. What's the go? And we talked about it and some sort of stuff. And I said, listen, that's all well and good, but you do know, like I broke the handle on my post-hole shovel last week, so I can't dig the hole yet because I knew he had, you know, they were actually trying to see if they could fix him up, you know. Oh, righto, okay. I said, yeah, but, you know, when and if the time comes, we can sort this out. So, yeah, 3 months later, 4 months later, whatever it was, I get the message and I go and see him in the hospital and it's a palliative situation. And as I walked into the room, and he's sitting there and he's on oxygen and he pulls some mask sort of down and he goes, you better put a handle in that bloody shovel, boy. we're up.
That's true.
And so he, lovely old fellow, he's buried over there in the cemetery over that hill. And, yeah. But anyway, yeah. Gee, you better put a handle on that bloody shovel, boy.
Do you think young people handle it differently to older people, or is it just does it just depend on the individual? Is it a very individual thing, or is there a pattern that you've noticed?
Okay, I think to a certain extent, yes and no. Young people, if they're given that sort of diagnosis, they can generally be sort of, I won't say comfortable with it, but it's almost a just a realization, I suppose. So they get to a point, and then the point is a definite point. It might take some to get to that point to accept it. But once they've got to that point, it's whereas older people sort of it is dependent, I suppose, on the character type and those around and all that. There's a whole lot of different factors in that. Okay. But generally older people will sort of be, maybe because of experience, it's sort of, they think there's a validity in the why me. Does that make sense? So it'll go, you know, I so often at funerals, you know, someone's died, probably a bit ahead of time, whatever it is. And, you know, the comment will fly around it, you know, why is Fred gone now? There's basically, without putting too blunt a thing, like there's plenty of dickheads in the world. We could have done without one of them. That swing around. Okay, and I suppose that reflects with the way how more mature people sort of think about it, I suppose. They just try and balance it up, whereas a young person doesn't try to balance it up as much.
Do you come across many people that seek you out for comfort but are angry with God?
Yeah.
And blame God for an illness?
Yep. And when I was working with the number of chaplains that I had, very worst thing you can do as a lady of God, a man of God, or a chaplain in a situation is to hold your hand up and say, no, I've got an answer for that, because you don't. Okay. You know, I will happily say that I am a person of faith, but boy, I don't. Some of the things you see, some of the people you lose and you wonder why, and some of the circumstances, all those things, right? I don't have the answer. Okay, I don't have the answer. And the correct answer is, no, I don't know. So if someone is angry with God, they're very entitled to be angry with God. I mean, the Psalms, nearly all the Old Testament is a reflection of God being angry with people and people being angry with God. Is it? Okay, so that's if you look at the Psalms, it's, you know, why, God, have you done this? You know, to be without being too blunt about it, but to be pissed off with God is probably a necessary position to start faith. So, you know, there'll be people that'll hear this and go off their nut. That's okay, I don't care. I'm, who who I am, and I don't mind. But that's the reality of it. And I suppose if I'm not, and I'm not going to preach, I'm not preach it at all, right? But if there's an area where that space that exists where, no, we just don't have the answer. Science doesn't have the answer. I don't know why. There is no answer. That's actually the space in which faith works. Because only faith works where there is no other answer. Does that...
Mm.
Okay. And I'm not, you know, your faith's going to be different to my faith, different to Paul's faith, different... Everyone's. I can remember when we used to, back in the days when they had Sunday schools, and I'd teach Sunday school. And you'd get the kids, the really small kids, to draw a picture of God, and you never got the same picture.
Is that right?
Never. Okay. So.
Because I recall being a little kid, and Sunday God school, was yeah. definitely an old man.
Was he?
A big beard.
Oh, the big beard. Yeah, no, I get that. That's
sat
right.
on a cloud, I believe.
Yeah, but I think if you got, if they, he does.
she does.
If you, the very junior people in Sunday school, right, I'd suggest, what you're saying is actually right, you know, and if I think back, you are 100% correct. But if you got someone who's five or six to draw the picture, they haven't been given that picture because that picture was given to you. It wasn't your picture, was it? Is that right? So you know what I mean? So if you get in someone who, a young person who has some sort of, I can still remember my daughter. My daughter's was the best one. We go to church on Sundays. And what was church about? Well, that's where and the fellow's name, the minister there was Gary Toll. Lovely fellow. That's where Pastor Tell has God, the building.
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, Joanna used to say, oh, that's where he's got God, in that building. Go and see God every week because the pastor's got him in there. You know? Like it was the, that. So that was her, at a very young age, that was her vision. Like sort of suddenly.
The building.
Well, God, yeah, God was walking and we get back to it.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, righto, whatever. So yeah, I don't know. Probably haven't answered the question for you, but that's all right.
No. Back to where we started with all this. When you're visiting the pub, sometimes you're there just for a beer. But I think that cross on your shirt says that you are always ministering to people, really, no matter where you are, because you wear that shirt. You don't have to wear that shirt with a cross on it, do you? But you do.
Yeah, I do.
We talked about that before we even started recording this podcast, but you're always ministering to people, and that means you're always offering an ear. So this is just my perspective on it. When you walk in there and someone talks to you, and that someone may be in need, they might not even express it to you. God is there, surely.
Yeah, it is. And I suppose, okay. I get up in the morning when I go of a morning, I make a conscious effort, if you want to call it a prayer, you can call it a prayer or whatever it is, but I make a conscious effort to be a part of what God is already doing. Okay.
Yep. I'll have to think about that one.
So if I go into there, that's what it is. If I can help, I can help. If I can't help, I can't help. If it's sort of, and if nothing comes in front of me in the day which requires some sort of perspective on counsel or whatever, then that's fine too. But I, you know, very much sort of, you just need to be aware of that, and you need to not make it what you're doing. Right? So there's a big difference between in the morning, get up and go, I want to be a part of what God's already doing, or you getting up in the morning and going, well, where can we find someone that, you know, God may be needing? They may need God, or
yeah,
God wants them to talk to me, or whatever. Is that?
Yeah, yep.
Okay, so that's a sort of philosophy, I suppose, of ministry that I've always had. But just, you know, you be a part of what God's already doing. My faith is such that I sort of, you know, this is all happening. I don't understand a lot of it, but I'll be a part of it.
And this is again, you're living a life of God. That's the point. Yeah, you're not going out there saying, my goal today is I must have five people.
Yeah.
You're living your life, but you're trying to be there for people at the same time. Is there anything you can say right now, so we wrap this up, to if somebody's listening and they are fearful of losing their life, whether it's something that they have imagined or it is something that they've just been told.
It's real.
That is definite. You know, this is the end days for you, months, years, whatever. What would you say to that person listening?
It's going to be a bit tough, but take the time to search into your heart for, firstly, the strength to go, well, this is what's in front of me, I'll have to deal with this. But more importantly with that, think about those that are around you. So you'll get to that point where you can do that. And think about those that are around you. Every day, tell those that you love them. And it's important for those that are around you to do the same, the flick around. Okay, so do that. Part of me likes to advise people when they get the diagnosis to say, listen, is there anything we really need to reconcile? Specifically with God, but if with God, that's fine as well. But what about those around you as well? Is there someone that you need to be reconciled with, and what can we do to maybe help that happen? Because now we've been given the destination time of your arrival, so we won't be able to do that after. So I've done lots of funerals, and some of the most powerful funerals I've ever been. Those where it's been a time of reconciliation and love, and you get to the funeral, and, you know, this period of time from, okay, my diagnosis is I'm not going to be around, to here's the funeral, has brought not only that person to a point of peace, but it's brought those around together. They're beautiful moments. So does that help or not?
No. I think it does.
And get help. Look, the first thing, if you're really struggling, don't hold that struggle yourself. Seek out someone.
When I was younger, I always thought if you had a terminal diagnosis, you should just run away and just head bush. But I feel differently about it now. You know, like I think connecting, as you just said, dealing with those things that's what's important, just reconciliation, preparing yourself. You still, I think you probably still need alone time, but connecting is the thing. Make your connections, reconciliations, make your peace with the world, I guess. If you've got the time, do it.
Very good, Angela.
No time like now, eh?
Yeah,
I've made some chocolate cake, Rev. Let's go eat. Thank you for coming in and being part of the Downhill Slide.
Thank you.
And to you, thank you for listening.